It is Saturday, October 29th, 2011. We're broadcasting live from the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio. Today on the program, we have Mike Rotkin, former mayor, city councilman, talking about desalination. We'll be talking all about the city's plan to possibly create a desalination plant to help with the water crisis.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI.
It is time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today's theme is by Dave Pretora, Pet Star Music. Thank you so much for making that. And, oh, not Pet Star Music. No, Dave Pretora. Thank you very much for your theme. If you'd like to make a theme and I can mess up your name on the air, please feel free to do so. You can find out more information at geekspeak.org. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
We also have Ben Jaffe. Ben Jaffe is a freelance media guy and sometimes a Stanford instructor.
Ahoy, hoy.
Wow, nice. We also have former mayor and city councilman, Mike Rotkin. Mike, welcome.
Thanks for inviting me on the show.
We'll be talking about desalination and Santa Cruz water issues and all the different things that you know so much about on the second half of the show. And I invite people to stay tuned with us. If you have direct questions for us, we're not taking phone calls today, but you're welcome to give us an email. We will watch the email thread, and you can do that by going to geekspeak.org. So to start the show, Miles, what's up in the political world of geekdom?
In the political world, we have Bluecoat, a security company that deals with web filtering and sometimes some email filtering, but general network security. Turns out that their products are in use in Syria, which is contrary to our trade agreement. I mean, to sales agreement, or what is the sales laws?
Yeah, we're not supposed to be selling software to Syria.
Right. You don't sell critical systems to Iran, Syria, North Korea, that type of thing. They didn't sell directly, though. As it turns out, they had a some middlemen in Dubai that were taking their software and then reselling it again to Syria.
What's the software do?
Web filtering. So when someone goes online in Syria, they aren't given access to a bunch of different websites that may be politically inconvenient for the group at hand.
I see. And this is a commercial product made in the U.S.?
Yes.
You worked for a company that did this kind of stuff for a while, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
And this is traditionally really important in business environment where you want to protect your network, you want to make sure your employees aren't doing things they shouldn't be doing, and in general, be fascist, right?
I mean, well, I don't know about necessarily fascist.
I always gave you a hard time when you worked there.
So. Yeah, when I started there, I did have a strong notion of, what am I doing here? What is this even right? The internet should be free, data should be free, that type of thing. And what it came down to is, one, I met too many salespeople, and
they were really good at really convincing quite, you.
It's really interesting how many salespeople browse porn on the company internet.
Ah, I see.
And also, it talks about, like, for example, in schools where you cut back on the hardcore stuff, you know, that type of thing. Also at work, they would cut down on things like Facebook, except during work hours or a certain amount per day, that type of thing, just to scroll it down. There is that argument of someone does their job or they don't. It doesn't matter how they get their job done.
But at the same time, and if you're a business owner and you own a network and you have a whole bunch of resources, including computers and staff time, it seems like it is your purview to monitor or change what people can do on that.
Right.
System.
What we did find, though, is that after a company, they were like running out of bandwidth for the company network, they instituted our software, and suddenly they were like, okay, we're already on a T1, we need to move up to something else. And then they put in our software, and suddenly it's like, oh, we've got plenty of bandwidth.
Also, Pandora wasn't running for everybody. And, but that's in a corporate environment, in a business environment, where you're being paid to be there and do a certain job. This product now is being used, not the product you used to work for, but this another company has gotten it to Syria, and they're using it for general populace control.
Right.
And that's a very different thing. And whether that's something that we agree with or not.
Well, it's a sliding scale anyway. There is argument on the corporate side as well. But yes, for a government to do so is...
And social issues is one of the reasons we don't sell directly to Syria, why there are rules in place. Mm-hmm. And so this business is skirting those rules. The thing is, software. I mean, you get a copy of it, anybody can run it. So it seems to me, I bet a lot of stuff's run there that's made in the U.S.
Yes. Blue Coat also makes hardware appliances as mm-hmm. well. And that's actually what's showing up in Syria is the hardware appliances.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
And also, the federal stuff against exporting this technology is not against having any kind of software sold to Syria. They put limits on what they think might eventually come back to haunt us in terms of an attack on the United States.
Right. Or subjugation software and software that enforces policies we disagree with.
Exactly.
All right. Well, Ben, what's up in on the planet?
Well, on our pale blue dot, we now have 7 billion people as of just earlier this week. So, I don't know.
I thought it was tomorrow night.
I thought it was Halloween it was going to happen.
No, it actually happened already.
It has happened already. I think this is completely terrifying and everything. But so I was reading a bit about this. A lot of people are making the argument that it's not really... It's the expanding population that's causing so many of our problems. The bigger culprit is the overconsumption of the Western world, you know, or the overconsumption that the Western world engages in. That's a better way to phrase that. There's a really fantastic website, though, that I wanted to point all of our listeners to, 7billionactions.org, and this will be up on the GeekSpeak website. But they have a lot of data, cool charts and all kinds of stuff about things like fertility, births, deaths, growth, looking at the world's population in terms of young people versus adults versus seniors and kind of how those numbers are changing. It's a really cool website, and it kind of lays out a lot of this data that we're getting and makes it a little more understandable.
Cool. Also, 7billionactions.org.
7 billion, that's 7, not spelled out. It's 7, the number 7. Seven
right, we'll have that up at geekspeak.org as well.
We will indeed. And we're continuing to increase by about 10,000 a year. So an hour, I'm sorry, not a year. 10,000 a year, wow. This is slow. No, every 13 years we've been increasing about 1 billion. But
so
of course,
7
it's accelerating.
People, that's a lot of eyelashes.
That's a lot of eyelashes. Just imagine how many nose hairs that is.
Now, the question is, which one of the 83 billion people that have ever lived on this planet are you? 83 billion.
83 billion is how many humans
right.
have lived here?
And, all, I mean, what, 8% of them are currently alive right now.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's a big percentage.
The show that I was doing a while back, Here After Here, a couple months ago, mm-hmm. One of the really interesting things that they brought up in the show was the dead will always outnumber the living, no matter how many people we have on Earth. Yeah. Now, that's technically not true, but it really is, you know?
It's like, true because of the finite limits of the Earth. Otherwise,
that's
it wouldn't
true.
Be true
at all. But like, if everyone had a bajillion babies, one after another, everyone, and then everyone died, then for just a moment, we might actually have more people. But anyway, it's kind of an interesting concept to think that even though we're increasing like that, the exponential scale is such that we'll never quite outnumber the number of people who have died.
All right. Since you've done the humanity, let's start getting a little smaller, the definition of human in the brain area. Miles, you got a brain story for us, human brain story?
Yes. Sweet. IBM, that wonderful company that has, you know, more people than I think the county of Santa Cruz does as employees.
Oh my God! Really?
That's true.
Yeah, they're massive. When people think of IBM, it's hard to grasp how many people are involved with IBM worldwide. They have supercomputers. In fact, they have some of the fastest supercomputers in the world. So what are they doing with them? Well, one of those things is they're simulating brains.
What do you mean simulating human brains?
Well, they're trying to do a human brain, but they've only gotten 4.5% of the human brain.
Very
Which is still
hey,
more
so
than...
you only use 10% of your brain.
You
brain. That's not true.
They have to get the right 4%.
Right. Right. One thing to keep in mind, though, is that think of how big the human brain is. And now think of the fastest... One of the fastest computer supercomputers in the world can simulate 4.5% of that.
Of this lump of tofu?
Of one of 7 billion examples.
Okay.
Currently
that computer
existing.
Fills a room probably, or more. It's a huge computer.
Oh, yeah. That's got to be incredible infrastructure to run it.
But they are able to simulate all of a cat brain.
All of it?
Well, a cat brain is about the size of a walnut. So
yeah, it's a little different. Like, so they can get something they can get a human being that's aloof, doesn't care about anybody else, and likes to scratch things.
Well, this is just the hardware, though, right?
How do they know they're simulating the cat brain successfully?
That would probably garner me a PhD. But
wow.
So, they've simulated the brains of several animals. The brain of a mouse, which apparently took 512 processors working in parallel. A rat took a little over 2,000 in parallel.
Now, do you know if...
And a cat took 24,000.
I'm assuming that what they've got is a computer representation of the synapses firing. But they don't actually have the program, if you will, of the cat running. Do you know what I'm saying?
But that's like saying we have a simulation of the original PC CPU, but we don't have every peripheral that it's connected to. Because that's what the human experience is. You have the brain connected to all the sensor equipment
and the software.
But also the idea that you don't necessarily have the same function happening in the simulation. You know that the simulation could run that function, but it doesn't necessarily have that function.
They're looking at patterns. This is like saying we don't know exactly what programs are running on that PC simulation, but we know how that processor works, and when we put in input, we can see how that reacts.
Okay, imagine running the test package to this cat brain, Miles, as a programmer. How do you do that?
Once again, I would have a PhD if I could answer that question. Although they are able to make a prediction about how many processors it would take to rival one of the 7 billion brains that are currently on
That's really cool.
It would take 880,000 processors working in parallel.
To do one human brain.
To do one human brain.
Wow. You better be a really important thinker.
Once again, you got to get the right brain.
That's right.
Or the right part of the right brain.
Right? You just get like the brain functions, you turn it on, you have an AI, it's functioning perfectly. It's like you want fries with that? Like, oh.
Oh, no.
Just an average human. Oh, we want superhuman. What's up with the cars, Ben?
So I was having a conversation with some friends about cars and their hackability in a bad way. Someone pulls up to you and hacks your car through Bluetooth. It's just kind of timely that I came across a story, not talking about exactly that, but talking about a really, really, really major software fault with Jaguar cars. If you have a Jaguar car, maybe you want to go on their website and check this out. But they're recalling 18,000 cars because they've identified a potential issue wherein the cruise control will not turn off. Even if you press the button to turn it off or hit the brakes, it'll just keep going.
That seems like a pretty bad
situation. It's a pretty bad
situation.
One. You could always turn off the car while hurtling across the freeway at 80 miles an hour. But
turning off your power steering.
Exactly. Turning on your brakes and everything.
Can you put it into neutral? Then that would do
it won't do it. I guess it'll just...
But an engine can take that. It sounds really horrible.
And then how do you get it out of that?
Well, you don't.
What if you have to accelerate again?
That means that you're able to casually come to a stop or gradually come to a stop and still have some control over the car, still have some choice.
True.
I think popping neutral will be better than turning off.
Can I suggest that when you want to turn this thing off, it's usually because you're coming up on the back of somebody at a speed that's going to cause a crash, and by the time you think about what do I do now, it's over.
Does the brakes work?
Some of us are young enough that our reaction time might be a little bit faster.
Did you really do that? Ouch.
Wow. So my reaction time has got to be a lot better than yours, Miles. Anyway.
A lot better.
Yeah, much better. I'm like 2 years old if you listen to these guys. Anyway, so I just wanted to bring that up for anyone who has Jaguar cars. And also, What?
For all our listeners that have Jaguars. Yeah.
I know. I mean, I have one. Actually, they did also say that no customers have reported this issue. However, one of their employees noticed it on a model that he owned. So, I don't know. Maybe statistically unlikely. Maybe some other customers have had it, but haven't reported it.
This isn't hacking, right? This is just a bug.
This is just a bug. This is a software bug. But it just seemed to tie into my other conversation because we were just talking about different ways that cars, which fundamentally should be relatively simple devices, have become more and more complicated because of all these things we put on top, you know, and all of these other potential ways for really making a dangerous situation, you know?
Yeah. We're almost 15 minutes into Geek Speak, and we haven't even mentioned Facebook. So, Miles, will you please handle that for us?
Oh, no, please don't.
This is for all those statistics geeks out there.
Oh, I love statistics.
So, Facebook has a lot of people on it.
What percentage of the 7 billion?
I'm not...
like 82%.
No, just 1 in 7 people on the planet.
Do cats count?
Whoa, 1 in 7 people?
1 billion... Oh, I'm sorry. No, I'm talking about... 1 billion Facebook logins occur per day. So I don't know how many people that individual accounts. Right. But
that might be more. It might
be
less.
Wait, a billion logins take place a day?
Yes.
So it's not just 6 people doing it. Let's get clear about that.
Right.
And really fast internet connection.
And there are a lot of people who stay just logged in all day, so it doesn't change. But there are a lot of people that go from their desktop to the...
I didn't even know you could log out of Facebook.
I thought it was... to their desktop, to their cell phone, to all these other things. How many of those are compromised accounts, compromised logins?
You mean the login wasn't actually the owner of the account?
Right. Facebook actually really released a statistic.
Like less than 1%, probably.
And you are correct. Only 0.06% of those logins are compromised per day.
But if it's a billion.
Except that 0.06% means 600,000.
Oh, my gosh.
Per day.
Wait, those are criminal activities, right? I mean, that's not necessarily criminal.
Well, it may also be someone who goes to the Apple store. Yes, we know who you are. You go to the Apple store, you log into Facebook to try out the new iPad, and you're like, oh, hey, this is kind of cool. And then you don't log out. And so the next person comes by and goes, hey, check this out. This person's logged into Facebook. I think I'm going to point you to like some...
So that's not a full site.
Does that count as a compromised login, though? Because they were already logged in.
That might be compromised use.
Or is it like a stolen password?
No, this one's a compromised login. I mean, it's talking about compromised login. So that doesn't even count the times that people are hijacking.
How do they know what is a compromised login and what's not? How do they detect that? How do they know?
Maybe when they ask for security questions and things like that, maybe they can infer from at least using that as a starting point when you're logging in from a computer that it doesn't recognize.
Because I'm having like a mental debate about what my favorite child pet was, and all of a sudden they think I'm a compromised login because I don't know.
Well, or like Facebook have an official post, which is linked off the Ars Technica article I'll be putting up after the show. And just to really, have it be scary, just like the scale of it, one compromised login every 140 milliseconds on Facebook.
Wow. I really want to know what the compromise, how they determined compromise.
Maybe they ran a sample and just,
they might have just inferred
from it.
Yeah, it's very possible.
What is that? A little less than 8 compromised accounts logins per second?
Per second? Oh, my gosh. Well, yeah, it's 600,000 a day.
But,
it's got to happen pretty quick.
If they ran a sample with the numbers that they're seeing, I mean, if it's 0.06%, that's a lot of things, that's a lot of logins they have to manually go through, is that even feasible, really, time-wise?
0.06%, it seems pretty good to me. I mean, how are they going to get better at that?
Well, you can always get better, but still.
Yeah. I don't know. Humans have faults.
And this is a context where, think of how many idiots are putting stuff up themselves on their sites that nobody should be doing. Yeah. And this is just adding something to that.
This is nothing compared to the self-promotion of stupidity, right?
There you go.
And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of these compromised accounts were from people going to a sketchy site that doesn't know how to do OpenID correctly.
Right.
Or someone going to a site that pretends to be Facebook, but then just takes your credentials and logs you in for you.
Sure, there's definitely lots of ways to do this. Absolutely.
And those are maybe easier to detect, too. Once you know that a site is compromised, once Facebook knows the site is compromised, then maybe a bunch of people try and log in through it.
People
have a particular type of behavior. So if you see changing behavior of a certain pattern, it's probably not that difficult to
humans are also
do
pretty
a pretty good
So every presidential election cycle, we get into a big discussion about electronic voting and what systems are working. And we always talk about ATM machines and how good they are. But in the sense that, you know, you can seem to do that relatively regularly without much fault and flaw, and it seems to be pretty good, but it's more complicated to do voting. And then you look at something like this, Facebook, which is this giant company that makes lots of money and tries to do their best to make sure that it's safe and secure and all that, and yet you have this kind of numbers. You don't have a lot of faith in electronic voting.
Yeah, I was actually thinking in terms of ATMs when we think about how reliable they are. Mm. I'm wondering how many people out there would then say, there was yet another error in the bank's favor.
Right, right.
So who knows? But at the same time, if you really want secure transactions, you go to slot machines. Vegas right. has it nailed down.
It is never off of that 94% goes to the house number or something. Right. It's within about 7 decimal points out.
Yeah, yeah. All right. I guess you're going to talk about Miles. I mean, Ben, you're going to talk us.
I'm going to talk about Miles. Yeah.
Talk about Miles. Want to talk Windows?
Yeah. Sure. I'll talk about Windows. This is something that makes me not like Microsoft again. Not that I ever really liked Microsoft, but so for a really long time, Microsoft was in this situation with this antitrust decree basically saying that Internet Explorer could not be inextricably linked to Windows, right? You had to be able to remove it. And that's from back in the day when people were trying to remove IE and they weren't able to in order to use something like Firefox or whatever.
It wasn't so much that they weren't able to. It was more that it wasn't a choice and they were flooding the market to kill Netscape. So OEMs contractually couldn't remove it. But the user could. That was one of the things they found during the antitrust suit, is that a researcher was able to remove IE from Windows 95 without major detriment to the system.
Yeah, although that was a researcher. I mean, it was not easy.
A lot of technical skill to do.
Yeah, it was not easy to do.
I once tried on an office computer.
Well,
it's
no,
not
you,
easy.
You yeah. do it once. Yeah, it's very hard. But once you do it once and figure out how to do it, writing a script to do that is not that difficult.
So yeah,
and there actually were scripts that were doing that at the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well. That said, though, Microsoft now is tying IE10 to Windows 8, and it's okay because they're not legally bound by this decree anymore after like over a decade that they've been bound by this. But IE8 and IE9, they were removable and everything like that, like actually removable. IE10 is actually pretty linked to Windows 8. Things like, you can quote, turn off certain Windows 8 features, one of them being Internet Explorer, but it doesn't actually remove it. It just hides it or something like
yeah.
that.
Now, in fairness to Microsoft, they're reusing a lot of code.
Right.
So the mail reader is using an Internet Explorer rendering widget to show you your mail in HTML glory.
I hope it's using an IE.
Or actually, Outlook is using Word's HTML render for some reason, but that's another.
Yeah,
that's a whole other can of worms. But their help system has used the web browser renderer for quite a while. A lot of other components will use it, and a lot of third-party components will use it.
But
so
I'm
you
not...
can't really delete it per se.
Sure.
But one thing that's come up in the EU. Is that when Windows starts, this is one of their results from litigation, when Windows starts, the user is given a choice of which browser do you want to use, and uh-huh. it's in a randomized order, and the person says, I want that one, you know, and then they start using it. And I don't believe that would be the case in the U.S.
Probably not, no.
How did they come up with the list of browsers that are available?
It's basically all of the browsers that have any sort of market share in the EU. So okay. you're talking about Firefox, Chrome, Opera.
Right.
Seems to me I'm forgetting.
Whatever. Safari, maybe?
Sure.
I don't know. Safari doesn't have a huge market share on Windows, though. But I'm not just talking about the renderer, right? If the renderer was just kept there, that would make some sense. You know, like mm-hmm. OS X has Safari's renderer. Built in, and they use things like Canvas for rendering dashboard widgets and whatnot. But I'm talking about settings, you know, like in the tests that the people who were doing this article ran, they set specific settings on IE10. They removed IE10, and then they brought it back, and the settings were still there, right? So there's some degree of it not doing a full removal of whatever it actually can remove, you know? It makes sense to have a rendering engine in there, but it kind of seems a little weird to me that the actual application doesn't go away when you tell it to go away.
Configuration items, it's actually fairly common for a program not to delete its configuration items. Some of them do, but a lot of them don't. For specifically that reason that you're reinstalling the software, like installing and reinstalling this, you'll still have the settings. So I
the
don't,
library folder grows.
Okay. I don't know if that's quite a smoking gun right there.
Fair enough. Point temporarily retracted until I read more of the article.
Hey, you're listening to Geek Speak. In a second, we're going to do a geek bit by, I think, Mr. Elam. Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses and tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specializes in protecting data and have been providing data, storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBTech.com. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe and our special guest, Mike Rotkin. We'll be talking about desalination in a minute, but first a geek bit from Mr. Elam.
I never thought that I would bring up Justin Bieber in a Geek Speak story.
We're moving on.
You're doing well, Miles. Justin Bieber and Facebook?
Unlike many of our younger audience, many of you probably wouldn't know that Justin Bieber got his start by putting up YouTube videos and singing popular songs and then singing his own songs. And that it was a really just coming out of nowhere. Self-made person. However, there is some legislation going through Congress called Protect IP Act. And the idea is that you can't post a video of yourself lip syncing to something, among a lot of other items in that bill, which both the House and Senate are both working on a version of the Protect IP Act in parallel. But both of them have this provision. Basically, you have Justin Bieber coming out saying, wait a second, this is because if you do this, if you make unauthorized streaming a felony punishable by 5 years in prison, then you're
fine.
Yeah, then you're talking about YouTube ceases to exist. Period.
Like, why?
Because you're talking about unauthorized streaming of these copyrighted works, and you talk about the individuals that are posting these items, and it just becomes this cascade factor of a lot of these sites that we've come to know and many of us love would not be able to function in this scenario. And in fact, the next Justin Bieber
wouldn't exist.
Could not exist. Yeah. It's much the same thing as if our copyright laws existed today, Disney would not exist.
Right.
Though Disney is the biggest perpetrator of copyright.
I smelled a little bit about this legislation recently and was kind of shocked that it's coming to the forefront. It seems to have these horrible structures like this. I mean, I thought we kind of have come to the conclusion that we have to look at how our society functions and then make rules that fit that pattern. And
have you clearly watched?
I know.
Political debates lately?
No, it's too depressing. So we have people like Mike. He stays on top of it for us.
Yeah, right. It's like, I could stomach that stuff.
Thanks, Miles.
Hey, you asked for that geek bit.
It truly was a geek bit. I'll say that.
That's true. KOSP co-sponsors the Central Coast Independent School Fair, where parents, grandparents, and children can meet with representatives from Monterey Bay area private schools servicing students in pre-K through 12th grade. 6:30 p.m. November 8th at the Temple Bethel in Aptos. Information is at independentschoolfair.com. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. Starting in 1979, Mike Rotkin served at his first of six terms as Santa Cruz City Council member and has also been five times mayor of Santa Cruz.
That's correct.
And Mike is a lecturer at UCSC and director of field studies in community studies at UCSC, though that is finishing and ending soon, sadly.
Unfortunately, our dean decided that it's not a priority to have a community studies program. It's a program that sends students around the world, 6-month internships, working on social change issues.
Yeah.
And it's going to be ending. Our last class is sort of going through the major. They'll be done next year.
If you're a small organization that's used an independent study intern from UCSC, you might want to mention that to the dean that it's UCSC's one of UCSC's services that was important to our community. I think maybe that's another show, but let's go on. Mike was formerly against the Santa Cruz City plan to create a desalination plant, and this is a project. Water issues in Santa Cruz have been kind of going strong for years, and one of the plans has been a desalination plant. And yeah, I'd assume that you'd be kind of against the desalination plant. Can you tell me why you changed and then why you're in favor of it now?
Sure. First of all, people should understand that Santa Cruz most years has lots of water. We take surface streams. The San Lorenzo is our major source, two North Coast streams. We have a small well over on the east side of town, but mainly the San Lorenzo is our source of water. And we've had a water shortage, the risk of a water shortage in drought years for many years now, and that's the problem. Every 5 or 6 years we have a drought. Sometimes they're very serious. Our most serious drought was in 1976-77, and we found ourselves with forced cutbacks in watering and things like that. The chances of that happening again are probably pretty strong, although that's certainly debatable. No one knows for sure when the next drought will come or how serious it's going to be, but it's really, I would say, playing with fire, if we're not mixing with the water metaphor here, but it's a serious risk to suggest that maybe we shouldn't worry about droughts because they don't happen every year.
Right.
Our neighbor Soquel Creek has a similar problem. There's water shortages in certain years, and they're now overdrafting their aquifer. And they're totally dependent on wells and looking at the real risk of saltwater intrusion, which will permanently destroy an aquifer.
And aren't they in this point where they definitely will have to turn off water service if a drought phase comes into play?
Yes, and they already, as I said, their water levels are dropping, and there's a concern that they'll follow the Pajaro Valley, which is the worst overdrafting situation in the world, according to the...
So overdrafting, you pull too much water when you're coastal, and you pull too much water from the aquifer. The fear is that saltwater will pour in.
It comes
in
to fill in
this. And then it only takes 10,000 years or so to get out of there, right? So it's basically over.
It can't be reversed. Yeah. That's the problem. And you say you want to stop it from happening. And right already, Soquel Creek is moving their wells inland, mm-hmm. away from the ocean.
And they have a lot of test facility wells, right? Small pilot wells that kind of skirt the area to determine if there's water coming in that's going to salt.
Exactly. They're trying to figure out how bad the problem is and what to do about it. So anyway, the two districts are both looking at desalination. Well, years ago, the city of Santa Cruz killed the project for building a dam on Zioni Creek, which had, first of all, is 600 feet from the second biggest earthquake fault in the state, had a serious impact on fish populations, and just generally was concerning people because of the scale of the project, its cost.
How many homes would have been taken out from that dam if it had been done?
Well, if you think about this, it's on the San Lorenzo River. I mean, an exact number, but thousands of people would have been affected by that if that dam were to go.
Okay.
And the number of drowned, who knows?
No, I didn't mean if it had failed. I mean, if the dam had gotten put up, how many homes had to be sacrificed to put the dam up? I mean, isn't that part of the...
Not many.
Okay, so it's
that wasn't Zioni the issue. It's way up in the valley there.
You just lose that road that takes you forever to get to summit.
Exactly. Yeah. But the main problem would be, as I said, the risk for people downstream and the impact on the fish populations, aquatic life in the San Lorenzo River,
sure.
downstream. Anyway, I've always been opposed to desalination just because the energy costs were high and everybody mm-hmm. understands that you don't want to, particularly now, we don't want to be wasting a lot of energy and causes greenhouse gases and global warming.
Yeah, you're basically, I mean, the talking point is always turning gas into water. Like that's what you,
yeah.
because it's our electrical output in this area is by natural gas burning.
Right.
And
but
so
it wasn't me alone, but on the basis of the rational decision to not go to desal, the city investigated all kinds of options for like where we might get water. We drilled every place you could look on the west coast of west side of Santa Cruz and came up with virtually no water. A thing called a rainy collector, which every stream has a subsurface stream below it, and you can capture water from that even when the San Lorenzo is looking dry. Is the underground stream still happening?
Well,
not enough water there. That didn't pan out.
Okay, we have tons of water in the winter times.
Yes, we do.
Couldn't we? The
it's
question
a storage
is where
problem.
You put it.
It's a storage problem,
right.
And in fact, some of the opponents of desal are arguing that you know we could. Either find a way to store it easily. And ultimately, that might be a solution. You could store the water, for example, in the Felton Quarry when it stops being an active quarry,
mm-hmm.
or in the Granite Rock Quarry that's down along the coast on Highway 1 across from Wilder Ranch.
These are big pits.
Basically, and will be bigger by the time they're done using them. And they're not an instant solution because they're not played out completely. They're still mm-hmm. using those quarries. But you have to think of the political fight that would go on if the people of Felton were asked to give up their quarry, and there's concerns about what, even though I don't think they would play out, of what the impact of doing that would be on the local wells and so forth. One of the solutions we looked at was a brackish well on the north coast.
Brackish well?
It's like where you take water that's not quite as salty as the ocean, but that's got some salt in it, which therefore brackish. And it takes less energy to desalt it than it would mm-hmm. to desalt the water from the bay or the ocean.
What about putting water back into aquifers? Is that possible?
That's a possibility. It has to be done experimentally. No one knows how well recharging actually works. So one of the proposals is a water transfer. In years when there's lots of extra water flowing down the San Lorenzo, you'd move that water over to Soquel Creek. They would find a way to recharge their wells, put the water into the ground, which would raise their well levels. That is something that's worthy of further investigation. The city supports that. Soquel Creek's looking into that. But that's not a short-term solution. Even the major proponent of that water transfer, who's the county's water director, John Ricker, has said this is not a short-term desal solution. This is more like something we could work out over the next several decades to figure out whether it actually would help us in the long run.
I mean, we do kind of an amazing thing draining an aquifer, right? We tap it all over the place and pull little tiny amounts of water constantly from it. So you'd assume that you'd have to put water back in the same way, but you can't.
You don't know whether it'll trip, whether it'll recharging it, whether you do that.
Sometimes you just fill up your water point.
You do it with surface ponds and the hope that it'll sort of run down through the ground back into the aquifers. But nobody knows what that rate of recharge is or how whether you really could depend on it. So meanwhile, after investigating every, I didn't even list half the things that we got into, we realized raising this, for example, why not raise the level of the existing Loch Lomond Reservoir by raising, well, it turns out fish and game, if you did that, would require you to release even more water than we release now. It would end up with a net loss of water to the city system. But we investigated that. We looked at everything.
Loch Lomond Reservoir, of course, is up in the Lompico, above Ben Lomond, and it's actually Santa Cruz City owned.
And that's our major source for droughts right now.
Yeah, that's the Santa Cruz only really large scale water storage.
Yeah, and it's got this recreation in the summer months. You can get a paddle boat.
Highly recommend it.
Except you can't put your kayak on it anymore because of the...
There's a mussel that will destroy our entire water system if we get one of them, or two, it takes two, I guess, two of them in the system, it would be all over. So I'm a kayaker and was hit by that as well. I have to stay on the bay now and can't go up to
Loch Lomond. Why don't they have kayaks there that they rent?
They do.
Okay, good. Well, there you go.
What you can't do is take yours up there. They have paddle boats and a bunch of other row boats and things like that.
And considering how little I kayak now, I would think that no mussel would be able to survive on the back of my kayak anymore after sitting out.
Well, they used to like hose them down and inspect them and stuff, but it's just, again, the risk. All it takes is two of these. They end up multiplying and they just destroy water systems. They fill up the pipes and everything else, and you literally have to
It's a non-native mussel that happens to be all over the place.
Very
in California,
invasive, yes.
And it fills up pipe lines and really damages things.
So, Benny, quickly back to the story. So we looked at every other possible alternative. We don't want to go to desal because it's expensive, it's energy intensive. Let's try and find something else. And at the end of exhausting that, came back to desal. And let me just say, people should understand, if we had a drought, not some one of these droughts we know about from the rings of redwood trees, 80-year droughts or something, but a drought we've experienced in 1976, 77, the same level drought again here, which is very possibly going to happen, almost likely to happen. We would have to make cuts in our water use. First thing that would happen is, at that level drought, you'd have to stop all outdoor watering. Not water in the evenings twice a week or something. Get rid of your garden. Some of your fruit trees are going to die. Some will survive it probably. No lawns, that's fine. No outdoor watering cars. No outdoor water use. And then you'd have to go back.
What about home gardens that you're producing food in?
Doesn't matter. Yeah. Because there wouldn't be the... Here's the point. You might make all kinds of arguments about what we ought to do. There will not be enough water.
Okay. And so what about farming?
Farmers would be seriously hurt. Nurseries, farms, businesses, local businesses would end up failing. We've done some studies of this issue. Now, we've accepted that in a drought, we should cut back our water use. We shouldn't plan so there's always so much water that you never have to cut back. And after an extensive study, the city decided we could survive a 15% cut in our water use, which is what we did last summer. Mm-hmm. We got 14%, but pretty close. One of the major things the city's done is try and develop conservation programs, and we've done incredibly well at it. The city of Santa Cruz now uses about half the average water in the state. We're one of the lowest water users, maybe top two or the two or three lowest water users in the state of California. And yet, what I'm describing to you is still the situation that would happen to us if we had that kind of drought. After you're done not watering outdoors, then you have to go inside, and you're going to have to find a way to save between 20 and 30% of your indoor water use, about 26% of your indoor water use. Now, back in 76, we did that by putting bricks in the toilet and all kinds of technical, cutting back and not, yellow, let it mellow. If it's brown, flush it down. Kids used to run around chanting that. But we already have low-flow toilets. You can't put a brick in your toilet now.
It won't flush anymore.
a shower, cut back. We already have low-flow shower uses. Most people in town already have low-flow washing machines and dishwashers and stuff. So where are you going to save 20%, 25% of your indoor water use?
Smellier population?
Less baths, lots of other kinds of things like that. So we're at a place now where desal becomes a serious consideration for us, because we've exhausted every other alternative. And let me just quickly say, what are the issues about desal? People will raise three major concerns. One is, what about the putting the briny salt back in the bay? Isn't that going to be an environmental problem?
Can we talk about the technical side of it?
Sure.
Talk about the side
of course.
So desalination, you take salt water from the ocean, you filter it to some degree so there's not organisms in it and such.
It does it through what's called reverse osmosis. You have a membrane that has got really small holes in it that basically let the water through but not the salt molecules that are bigger. And that's the technology. And it takes a fair amount of pressure to push the water through that membrane, and that's where the energy cost comes.
How do you clean the membrane?
You reverse the water through it.
You flush it every once in a while, just like a home filter system.
Or like a pool or something. You basically go backwards.
A giant amount. To get the amount of water through this thing that you need a large facility to have a lot of membranes.
Just to get a sense, we're looking at, because we still are going to have lots of other water, even in drought years, that you get some water at certain times of the year. So we're looking at a 2.5 million gallon a day plant. Soquel Creek would need to use that plant, half of that plant's capacity, 1.25 million gallons a day, all the time, in non-drought years. In drought years, the city would take it over and use all of its capacity, 2.5 million, and Soquel Creek, which would have been resting its wells while it used this desal water, would be able to draw their wells without having the level drop precipitously in a drought year.
So you have a membrane, and the water molecule can fit through. And basically, you produce a low pressure on the side that you want to get the fresh water in.
Exactly.
High pressure salt and salt water on one side.
Slowly,
the water molecules find themselves through this membrane without the salt. So what about other contaminants that are in the system?
It takes them out as well, almost all of them.
It's a really good membrane.
It takes out the heavy metals. It takes almost all the stuff you'd be concerned about. And the water you end up with, which we did a test well, one-tenth size of the final plant over on the west side of Santa Cruz. We ran it for a year and a half, a year and a quarter. And basically the water that comes out is pure water. It's not as pure as if you boiled it and then, and captured the steam and so forth. But it's as good as the water we get coming down through the filtration system that exists at the water plant through the Santa Rosa River. And so it's clean. I've tasted it. It tastes fine.
Yeah.
You want to add a little bit of stuff back into it so people don't think it's strange.
So one thing you've got a giant capital investment right off the bat.
Yes.
That's an issue. How do you pay for that?
We've had rates raised for over some time to gather some money already. We'll do some additional raises of rates. Let me start with the energy issue, maybe before I get back to these other ones. Well, let's finish with the salt water thing.
Yeah.
Actually, I started on that.
The briny salt.
So we have a complete solution for that,
Which
is we're going to take that water and mix it with the wastewater, treated wastewater that already is going out into the bay right now. It goes out through a 4-mile pipeline, drops into about a mile deep trench off the coast. And the last half mile of that's a diffuser that sends the water out through holes in the end of the pipeline. So we would mix the water together. It would go back into the bay at exactly the same salinity that was taken out in the first place. So that problem is gone. There is not a problem of saltwater
concentration. We have a way of getting rid of that salt water.
That is salt.
And in fact, you could assume that putting salt water down there that's our runoff, if you will, is more closely related to what kind of water would be down at that level.
Absolutely. We're putting more fresh water back there.
And the water
now
we're talking about is the sewer system water, right?
It's already going there now. It just would add the salt water to that.
Okay, so the briny water, the really high concentrated salt water that you get out of the output of this thing, goes
That's not a problem.
Not
we've
a problem.
Totally solved it. I mean, there really is nothing. Okay, it's not only like minimal impact, no impact.
What about running all these pumps off electricity?
Okay, so there's two other issues, energy, and the other is what about sucking up sea life in the intake? So let's talk first about the energy issue.
Yeah.
First of all, this has to be put in scale. It's a fairly large energy user. It would use the same energy as used by Dominican Hospital. So that's not nothing. That's a significant amount of energy use. But if you distribute the energy use, just to give your listeners an idea of like, well, how much energy is it using? If you distribute the energy cost to all the users, the homes and the businesses that use it, it would increase their energy use 1% over their current energy use, which is to say not a great deal of increase. It increases the water department's use of energy by only 3% over what they're currently using now.
Really? Wow.
So it's not that much on some level. It is, but you know, any amount of energy increase these days has got people nervous or something. So both Soquel Creek and the city of Santa Cruz have made an absolute commitment that they will build energy production, alternative energy production at the local level that will replace the energy that's necessary for this plant.
What kind of
solar panels on the roof of every city building? We've already been building these over the corporation yard. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of roof surface on city buildings.
So, Mike, it sounds like we got a lot of well-intentioned people figuring this problem out. And I I've known you all my life and trust your standpoint on most things, and I'm glad you're looking into this and dealing with this. But, you know, the story earlier, we talked about 7 billion people on the planet. Isn't this how we, the issues that we run into, isn't it small steps like this that cause this these big problems?
Well, like I said, if you simply ignore, I agree with that comment, and I think if you ignore the energy question, just say, well, it's only 1% per household, you know, what's the big deal or something, well, then you're adding to, you know, basically greenhouse gas production. We're not doing our part. And City of Santa Cruz, I think the people that live here and the city government want to try and respond to this crisis and try and reduce our energy footprint, carbon footprint. So the idea is, rather than simply looking the other way, we will figure out, which we've done, how much energy will this plant actually use. If you go try and be conservative, assume that you're going to use it a lot, might produce a lot of energy, get that number, and then figure out how many solar arrays will it take.
Okay.
Some of the energy can be captured by designing the plant in a way that the water running through it generates electricity. So you get, because there's actually, since water's moving.
What are they using?
There's the water, the whole idea that you're taking water out of the bay and running it through a filter and then running to people. That water has pressure and therefore can be used to run turbines that you can actually produce some energy. Except so you can produce, you can capture about 20% of the energy use through the plant. In other words, reduce the energy demand by about 20% by plant design. Okay. That still leaves about 80% of the energy that you need to have happen. Now, SoCal Creek's going to have to build more solar alternative and other kinds of alternative energy plants because they're going to run all the time at a million and a quarter.
Okay. Large-scale planetary question of solar panels.
Sure.
Solar panels seem great in a local, when all of a sudden, magically, you now have solar panels. But the actual creation of solar panels is not very energy efficient. It's kind of like a 20-year return on its energy expense, just the use of it.
And rare metals that you have to get
and the rare metals and
conflict areas.
Which are normally come from conflict areas, right? So just because we locally will be okay with solar panels and that would be great, it doesn't help our planetary problem.
I think you have to look at, which I've done some looking into, although I don't represent myself as an expert on that. Because the solar panel, once it's built, now lasts about 30 years, actually minimum 30 years. I have them on my own roof.
Yeah.
Which is great. It's definitely a way to save your energy bill and stuff like that. Over the 30-year period of its use, in the end, you're going to actually get some real energy savings. It's not going to be, like you said, it's not 100% because there's energy used in making solar plants.
Right.
To say nothing of the fact that the plants tend to create waste products that people always tell me, why don't we just build solar panels in Santa Cruz? Well, you want to have solar panels in Santa Cruz. You don't want what happens to your water, groundwater, if you actually produce the waste
that's
making them and stuff. So again, solar panels alone may not be the long-term solution. We may have to come up with wind power or other kinds of options to make this work. But the city's going to, and SoCal Creek Water District are committed to coming up with energy alternatives that, so
at least locally,
do not create. We don't want to just go buy credits on the carbon market or something, which is another fake way of producing. It doesn't really produce new energy.
I agree. I think the carbon credit perspective that is a little weird. But at the same time, I really think that people need to seriously think about the impact of on the planet that solar panels create. It's not a magical solution. I think wind solutions are probably much more better in the sense they don't have good return as solar panels.
They have all kinds of other problems too.
They do.
Their impact to wildlife and bats and birds.
That's overstated. That's a particular area like Pajaro Valley. That was a
birds. Or, right?
Yeah. But
well, there's also technical solutions there which have to do with having larger wind turbines that actually move slowly, so raptors, for example, can fly through them without getting killed. In the ultimate pass, that's been a big issue up there, where there's been a serious bird kill problem. So there, again, I think in the long run there will be some technical solutions to these things. Somebody who quickly says everything technical will work.
But I think the desal plan of saying, if it's going to have a energy footprint, we have to figure that out. I think that's an important way of thinking about it, rather than just building it and hoping.
Sure, no, and we are studying that question, and we've hired consultants to work on it. We have the public deeply involved in this issue. The other thing I have to say about this, almost all the other solutions that people have come up with are also energy intensive.
Sure.
If you're going to transfer water from the Santa Cruz over to SoCal Creek,
it's comparable expense, right?
Not quite, but
where would this desal plant be?
Probably on the west side of Santa Cruz. Just get the size of the scale of it. It's the size of a very large living room. It's not as big as people might think it would be. It's small. It's smaller. It's the size of the studio. If you could pack it, you wouldn't really be able to walk around it easily. But you could pack it in the studio we're sitting in right here, which is
the whole plant?
About 15 by 50. Yes, it's a small little plant. It doesn't take that much.
Why are we putting it one in here when we have to get it to SoCal?
We need it here as well. And so we're just looking at where it makes the most sense because we're close to where the outfall is. because you don't want to have to pump the salt water back from Silicon Creek over here. Wherever you put it, you're going to have to get back to the bay somewhere.
Right, so you might as well be where we have that piping system.
And we're looking at an intake.
Do we have a piping system to SoCal? Are we connected already?
We wouldn't have a totally new piping system. We are on a border with them, and so we'd have to expand the size of some of our pipes so we could move water through our system, which gets kind of small piped by the edge of the border, mm-hmm. into larger pipes to be able to ship it across to Soquel Creek. And that would be an expense either for a water transfer system from the San Lorenzo River, which some people are supporting, or for a desalination project. Right. And so there's some cost involved in that. I mean, the major cost of the building is not the physical... simply alone, the building of this physical plant and its membranes and so forth. It's the changes you have to make to the overall water system, the mixing place where you're going to put the salt water together with the treated effluent from the sewage treatment plant. All those things cost money. So we're looking at something that we don't know for sure, but in the range of $100 million cost. That seems like a huge number. But again, when you break that down into 95,000 customers for the water system, that's just the city water system.
Right.
We'd pay half the cost. I'm not sure the numbers in Soquel Creek. They're going to pay the other half, roughly $50 million of it and stuff. They're going to have to spread that over their customers.
Now, you're speaking about this probably in more detail than we have today on Tuesday night, right?
Yes, the city council is holding a study session at 7 o'clock at the chambers on Church Street at the City Hall to look at the question of not so much desal per se, but looking at the question of what the city's integrated water plan looks like. That includes desalination.
And it's a public meeting.
It's a public meeting. They'll take public input. They're going to have presentations both from Desal Alternatives, a group that's opposed to desalination, explaining how they think they have alternatives to desalination. And I'm going to be making a presentation there from the point of view of why desal makes sense to be part of our water system. I really have to emphasize that. We're not talking about having city water depend totally on desalination. In serious drought years, which is not every year, we expect every 5 or 6 years, we would use this plant some of the time to provide additional water. We're trying to combine desalination with increased conservation, with a lot of other kinds of plans that we have, trying to find ways to reduce people's water use, which is really the one thing you want to do first as an environmentalist.
We've been speaking with Mike Rotkin, former mayor, former council member, knows a lot about what's going on in Santa Cruz, especially the water system. If you'd like to learn more about this whole discussion and issue, if you're in local, please do go to the city council on Tuesday evening at 7 o'clock to hear more about it and participate.
You might also want to check out scwd.com, which stands for Santa Cruz Water District or Soquel Creek Water District.
And we'll put that up on geekspeak.org. For KWSP and Geekspeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. The Geeks today were Ben Jaffe and Miles Elam, and of course, our special guest, Mike Rotkin. Thank you so much for being here, Mike, today.
Oh, I really enjoyed it. Thanks for inviting me.
You can find out everything we talk about at the show online at geekspeak.org for today's show, which is 29th of October. Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned now for Car Talk with Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers. For KWSP and Geekspeak, I'm Lyle Troxell.